Good afternoon, or good morning, good evening, depending on where you happen to be around the globe. My name is Jerry Gallagher. I'm part of Deutsche Bank's consumer staples team operating out of London. It's my very great pleasure today to introduce to you Emmanuel Babeau, the Chief Financial Officer of Philip Morris International. Emmanuel, welcome to Deutsche Bank's 18th Annual Global Consumer Conference.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for hosting us. Very pleased to be with you all to exchange about PMI today. I would like to start with a few opening comments, if you allow me, Jerry. Before that, certainly, I want to draw everybody's attention on our forward-looking and cautionary statement, which is on the slide that we've been providing. I'm sure you will all read them very carefully. So a few thoughts I wanted to share with you before we start, and certainly it's going to launch our discussion. First thing certainly is the fact that we are confirming that we are on track to deliver a very strong performance in 2021. And we are actually confirming our forecast of an adjusted EPS for the full year of 5.95. The outlook for the Q2 2021 with an adjusted EPS targeted of 150 to 155. Therefore confirming, you know, the momentum that we have seen in Q1. This full year outlook is not including anything related to the recent news that we have got from Saudi Arabia and the fact that our distributor have to a large extent lost in front of the Court of Appeal in the custom duty case. We are assessing the impact for us of that adverse decision. And we will accrue a number related to that event that we estimate today to be up to a negative impact on adjusted EPS of 18 cents. So that will be booked in the second quarter. Once we have the determination of the final number, we are still working on it. And as you understand, it won't be part of the adjusted EPS, but that would be, of course, included in the full EPS for the year. If I focus now on Q2, we are continuing to see very strong momentum on IQOS, and I will elaborate on that in a second. And at the same time, we are seeing an improvement on our combustible business with a rebound versus last year, which was a depressed quarter, as we all remember, but also with a nice commercial progress in a few markets that is enabling us to gain market share. Regarding IQOS, we expect continuation of a strong growth of volume globally, both quarter on quarter and year on year. We expect to deliver shipment of about 24 billion stick for the quarter. When we look at all our key markets, we do expect to see this strong growth, both, as I said, quarter on quarter and year on year. Now, if we look at the market share, we expect to deliver a very nice growth in market share globally and in all key markets year on year. And when it comes to the quarter on quarter evolution, as expected and as we flagged very clearly in Q1, because of seasonality and also because of some evolution of the CC market, where we have a decreasing illicit and therefore what we can track as a CC market growing artificially, we expect in our key market share to be about flat between Q1 and Q2 after what has been, I'm sure you remember, a very strong growth in Q1 versus 2020. We are very pleased to see a growing momentum on the category overall as we see investors growing investment and commitment to the category, principally on the low price segment. We believe that this increased commitment and increased momentum is going to further accelerate the growth of the category. And as the arch leader of the category, we see that as a very positive development. For the year, we are confirming that we are targeting to reach 95 to 100 billion stick. And we are super excited as we are getting close to the launch of IQOS ILUMA in the second part of the year. Now, on CC, we do expect to deliver a solid performance in Q2 with a rebound, as I said, versus markets that were impacted by the COVID crisis in 2020, but also with some good gain in market share versus the first quarter. When we look at the various situation by market, you have a first group of markets, the one that have been principally, I would say, impacted by the COVID crisis in Q2 2020, where we expect a good rebound. I could mention Spain, Italy, Indonesia as one of these markets where year on year we expect good growth. There are a number of markets where, as I said, we are clearly doing some very nice commercial action and with a nice success, and that's going to enhance our market share. Turkey and Mexico could be two examples of that group of markets. And then you have a few markets that continue to be more difficult, still impacted by the COVID crisis. And I would mention Philippines as one of them, and certainly an important one for us. We also expect some markets where we have little, if no presence, to be growing fast in combustible. That's going to be the case of Bangladesh. That's going to be the case of Vietnam. And that is going to artificially have an impact on our market share evolution because we have little presence in this market. I just want Jerry to finish rapidly by coming back on our webcast on sustainability that took place a week ago. We are really pleased with the level of attention and the attendance that we got on that day. We use this webcast to show how we are really putting sustainability at the very heart of our journey to become a smoke-free company. We elaborated on how delivering better product is potentially changing the life of 1 billion smokers. We explain how we are becoming a reference on all ESG matters. And last but certainly not least, we explain why we believe that investors have a big role to play in pushing the sustainability agenda. When there is a problem and when a company is working to fix the problem, exclusion is not the solution, we think. On the contrary, if investors are going to invest and accompany the company that is improving things, it's going to generate the right impact. It will be by its investment fostering the journey towards transformation and improvement. As a shareholder, they will have the possibility to track that the company continue to deliver in the right direction and according to plan. And they will be also able to communicate, publicize to public opinion, to regulator and government, and further enhance the journey. So we believe that investors, by investing in these companies such as PMI that are transforming and improving things, are having the right impact on pushing the sustainability agenda. That's it. Thank you, Jerry. And very happy now to answer questions from you and the audience.
Emmanuel, thank you very much. You've done a great job of, obviously I had some prepared questions in my head. You've done a great job of knocking them all out of the way and more questions coming into my mind, but hopefully we'll we'll get there. So we're going to take a fireside chat format, as you say. I encourage the audience to type in their questions as they can via the web link, and we can incorporate those questions through the remaining time that we have. So look, you touched on the trading, so and you reiterated your guidance. I think just to help us frame the level of comfort, and I'll have a follow-on question, is could you talk about your level of comfort at this point this year compared to this point last year, and whether you feel much more robust in terms of the guidance you're giving? And then as we move out of COVID, which may be more of a fourth quarter 2022 event, given, you know, the movement in travel retail volumes, duty free, heightened illicit trade, maybe excise increases, to what extent is it a naive question to ask you, is a COVID world not that too bad a world for tobacco business? I'm not phrasing that very well, but I'm sure you get the gist of the question.
No, I understand what you mean, Jerry, and I understand where you're coming from. Great question. So on the first one, on the level of comfort and the guidance, remember last year we stopped the full year guidance for a period of time precisely at that time of the year when we had little visibility, and we were giving a quarter by quarter guidance at that stage. And then at the end of Q2, we moved back to a full year guidance. Quite obviously today, you know, we don't have the full perfect visibility that we would have in normal time, but clearly versus a year ago, I think we have better visibility. The Western world seems to be progressively, thanks to vaccination, coming back to normal. I mean, doesn't mean that all the clouds, you know, have gone away, but we seem to be progressively getting back to a more, I would say, normal situation with a bit more visibility. Then in the new economy in emerging country, it's a kind of a mixed bag, but nevertheless, yes, I would say today we have a better visibility, far from being perfect for sure, but we have a better visibility. And that's, you know, with this increased understanding of visibility that we are building the guidance. Now, on your question on COVID, which I think is a question that, you know, it makes sense because everybody realized that a lot of the traditional parameters have been transformed through the COVID period. You mentioned duty free, which is, of course, you know, a negative for us. And when we are back to normal, that will be good news. Illicit trade is positive, although we are putting all our energy to fight against illicit trade. It's true that, you know, illicit trade is going down in COVID time. And that's good news, you know, for the tobacco company. I would say, you know, at the end of the day, without any doubt, any hesitation, we are very pleased to be back to normal if it is the path that we are following. Remember, we are in a very ambitious transformational journey, and a condition for success is the capacity that we have to explain to smokers throughout the world why IQOS and heat-not-burn category is a much better alternative to smoking. And to do that, we need to be back in a normal life where we have normal interaction, social time with the people, and where we are much more able, if you want, to create the link to connect and to make our story known to the largest population of smokers. Thanks to digital, despite, you know, the crisis, I think we managed to, I would say, mitigate the impact of this limitation. But it is very, very clear, that we believe that we should be able to be much more impactful and be much more efficient in converting people when we're going to be back to a normal world. So altogether, clearly, yeah, it's positive, and we are very, very impatient to be back to normal. Hopefully this is what's going to happen. But as we all know, there is still plenty of uncertainty.
Great. Thank you for that. So my next question is probably could be characterized as pretty aggressive to ask the CFO, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Your EPS guidance has proved too conservative over a number of quarters. What do you say to people who just automatically default to the top end of the guidance and maybe go a little bit higher? Why shouldn't they do that?
Jerry, fair question, and I take the challenge. I think everybody understands that in COVID time, it is clearly much more difficult to anticipate what's going to happen. You have so many parameters, and we've just been discussing it, that are, you know, dancing all around, and it was very difficult for the last 15, 18 months to have visibility. So in this environment, we've done, you know, our best to try to provide visibility. And it's true that in most cases in the past quarters, we came up with a higher number ultimately, which was a mix of market eventually being better than what we thought, but at the same time, certainly us doing stronger on IQOS and heat-not-burn than what we initially anticipated. So the combination of the two has meant that on a few occasions, it's true that we've been beating in a significant manner the guidance. I will always prefer, you know, things to be that way, but we are, you know, certainly, and hopefully now that we are gradually, as I said, be back progressively to normal. When we are building a guidance, we are putting the fairest reflection of our understanding of a situation at a certain point in time. So people should not expect us, you know, to be giving a guidance to beat him. No, we are coming with the best possible reflection, of course, to the best of our knowledge at a certain point in time. And I would expect that, you know, we're going to get better through this exercise as I said, you know, the markets are becoming more predictable.
Okay, thank you. I must apologize before I ask my next question. I'm working from home. My landline has just rung. My answer phone has kicked in, but hopefully I can talk
okay,
over.
Jay, that's fine.
You can talk over that process, so I apologize. I now want to pick up on the sustainability webinar you guys did last week and pick up also on one of your introductory comments there. Typically, an investor makes money in the equity market not by looking at where a company is, but by looking at where a company is going to. Now, if your trajectory of your new category products, whether it's be tobacco heating products or vaping or whatever, would suggest, and according to your own metrics you're pushing out in for future years, that the business will be much more of a non-tobacco business or a non-smoking business than it is currently today. So my question is, to what extent does that frustrate the business? Is there things you could do better in terms of educating people? You referenced the shareholders perhaps being able to do a little bit more with stakeholders. There feels like there's a lot of upside on the rating of the stock if people can buy into the whole EC agenda that the business has got. So what do you say to all of that?
Like in any transformation, Jerry, I think that a company has to understand that's by delivering, you know, tangible proof and evidence on the fact that it's not just wishful thinking, but, you know, they are delivering on the journey, that they will convince shareholders to join. And my feeling is that we are on our way to do that. So some have already joined the company and others are still looking at us and saying, well, can they really make it? And are they serious in their journey? And do they have, of course, the resources and the capacity to deliver on their ambition? So I'm not sure that there will be a kind of pivotal moment where suddenly everybody will say, oh yes, you know, they're there. Now you could have a few acceleration at a certain point in time. I think when you reach a number of symbolic threshold, that could be the case. And there will be quite many of them. We've been clearly setting the course. Direction is very clear. We said by 2025, we want to be predominantly a smoke-free company. I hope people will, fully buy in our transformation before then, because I think we're going to deliver in a very systematic and in a very, very incremental manner to get there. But I think it's for us to continue to come with the right transformations, the scientific evidence that continue to show, and you've seen that last week we've been showing more things on Japan that are going to show the impact on health. And that will be this accumulation of proof, evidence, achievement consistently in the same direction that will, I guess, you know, convince everybody ultimately.
Okay. Accepting you're on a journey, and I think I can't envisage a situation, and I could be very wrong, where Philip Morris needs to come to the market to raise equity for some transaction. I could be wrong, but I suspect that's most of would agree that that won't be the case. And most people on this call will have an equity bias, and will be thinking about ESG from an equity perspective. But there is the other side of the equation, which is your liquidity, your funding, etc. Have you seen any impact on your ability to raise the finance at attractive rates because of ESG concerns around at the moment being a combustible dominated business?
No, Jerry, the answer is no. And we have more than what we need, you know, in terms of resources, both, you know, credit line with the banks. Each time that we go on the bond market, we are very successful and oversubscribed. So we don't see that at all. Now, having said that, let's not be complacent. And that's why it's important that we are very clear on our journey, very transparent, and that we share this ambition and all the achievement, the milestone. We're doing that with shareholders, but as you can imagine, we are doing that with lenders as well. And therefore, we're working with all stakeholders. And I would say mirroring what is happening with the investors in equity, we see a growing level of interest from, you know, bondholder and even banks to better understand what we are doing and how they should understand our ambition to go for a smoke-free world. So today, you know, we have no issue, and in order to make sure that it continues, I think it's important that we keep this level of communication and transparency with lenders as well.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, if I think about your sustainability agenda, your rider ESG agenda, that makes me wonder whether there's a potential negative implication for margins. First, that's one question. But the second question aligned to that is, do you care? And what I mean by that is, if your sustainability agenda means there's a margin impact, that doesn't matter because the impact on your profitability will be offset by, I assume, a higher rating on the equity. So taking a hit on the margin, no matter how small, is worth paying because the rating will improve. How do you think about that?
Jerry, that's a fascinating debate. What is the exact cost or return that you get from your investments on sustainability? And I want to be very clear, first of all, I see the two dimensions, finance performance and sustainability performance, to be totally entangled. So, of course, you need to have great financial performance to have the resource to invest on sustainability. But in return, it's because you are becoming more sustainable that you're going to have on the long term, you know, better access to cheap resources because they're going to be renewable. You're going to have the right talent in the company that's going to join you, or you will have the right, I would say, mindset engagement from your people. And then, as you said, there is, you know, this implication on, okay, what's the re-rating on the multiple because you are a great company on ESG. And therefore, you know, how do you play that versus investment that you are making that could have an impact on the bottom line, but you're going to enjoy a higher multiple. All that to say that it's still, I think, probably a field in the making in terms of, you know, how do you assess that? But I have absolutely no doubt that you're going to get great return on your investment on sustainability. I think the return on the people is huge. You know, the involvement, the level of improvement that you get in the engagement, in the mindset, the energy that you have from your team when they have the feeling that they are contributing to the common good and to do great things is absolutely amazing. Then, of course, everything we do on manufacturing, supply chain, well, it delivers productivity, it delivers better access to cheap resources, and that's obviously getting in the right direction. So I really believe that it's quite an easy case, I would say, in terms of investment. I don't see that as a drag at all on our performance globally. On the contrary, it's a powerful booster.
Okay. I just want to move on and sort of think perhaps even bigger picture. So your statement of purpose says smoke-free alternatives are not risk-free and should not be used by youth or non-smokers. You don't want people to enter the combustible market. And a combination of those two suggests that within a finite period, you don't have a business. Can you, I'm not, when I say a finite period, I'm talking 40, 50, 60 years. Can you talk about that?
That's a very long horizon, but thank you, Jerry, for referring to our statement of purpose, which of course is a guiding element for us. I think nobody should be misunderstood. Yes, you know, we want to convert smokers, but today with slightly less than 20 million IQOS users at the end of Q1 for a total of 1 billion plus smokers, we're just scratching the surface of the waves. So you can imagine the growth potential that we have. And it's already last year, it was already close to $7 billion business. You know, so you can imagine what is at stake, you know, if we are successful in really growing this business, delivering this better product to the billion smokers worldwide. So we are definitely a growth company, as, by the way, illustrated by our objective for the 2021-2023 period, where we said more than 5% organic growth for revenue. And it goes, of course, beyond 2023 in terms of ambition to grow. And on top of that, as we have signaled, we are developing this beyond nicotine ambition that won't have the perimeter that you have defined, where we're going to capitalize on well-being, wellness I would say expertise that we have been building through our IQOS journey to deliver great sensorial experience, product, you know, delivering more energy, better sleep, really in the well-being sphere, I would say. So that's one pillar of our Beyond Nicotine strategy. And then the other pillar, which is everything linked to better health and notably on the respiratory drug delivery. So as you can see, we have already with our reduced risk product, fantastic growth opportunity. And on top of that, we are already working on the next growth generation with our Beyond Nicotine initiative.
Okay, I might come back to that depending on time. I now want to move on to the comment around potentially exiting combustible markets in the next 10 to 15 years. And that raises a whole number of questions in my head, but if I just sort of give you a sense of some of them, how much combustible profits are you prepared to leave on the table at the point of exit? Is there a low point of market-wide combustible share that you, the market needs to reach before you exit the combustible market? How do you ensure you retain that residual combustible share in vaping or heat or to tobacco heating products whenever that, that point is? And a lot can change in the next 10 to 15 years, excise probably being a key dynamic around all of that. So could you just sort of help us frame the debate around leaving combustible markets over the next 10 to 15 years against all of that and a lot more, I'm sure?
Jerry, I certainly understand, you know, the question, and it's a legitimate one. The time for answers will come, but at that stage, I have to acknowledge that there is one certainty, is that we will be one day a smoke-free company in line with our ambition to unsmoke the world. I'm not able to tell you when this will be the case and how it's going to happen. So I don't have the horizon and I don't have the scenario to get there. And as you can imagine, you have several scenarios. I'm frankly not able to say which one will happen ultimately because it will depend on so many things. One of them is that simply, you know, we're going to fully kill the combustible category, which is one objective that we have. And another one will be that at a certain point in time, you know, the combustible business will leave the perimeter of PMI. But again, you know, plenty of different scenario, absolutely unable to tell you what's going to happen and when. Now the landing point is known. We'll be one day a smoke-free company, and that will be absolutely in line with our ambition to unsmoke the world. In between, Jerry, if you allow me a comment, in between, we are retaining the very clear objective to be a strong leader in combustible. And that is really important to retain that position, which is not that antagonistic with the fact that at the same time, we want to kill the combustible category. So we want to kill the combustible category, but as long as this category exists, you know, we want to be today playing a leadership role in this category. That is, of course, you know, helping us to finance all the investment that are needed on reduced risk product. And we know that they are important. That will also give us capacity to start financing the Beyond Nicotine initiative and ambition. So that's going to be important. Second, let's be clear. As you know, we made very transparent. We want to convert smokers to our product, to IQOS and other reduced risk product. But if you lose the capacity to speak to smokers, if you lose the connection to smoker today, maybe, you know, a few years down the road, it will be different, but today, then I think you are losing some capacity to convert the smokers to your product. So I think it's really important that, you know, we have this connection with smokers to be efficient and impactful in conversion. Then, of course, all the relationship that we have with the retail, with the trade today through CC, it's also important if we want to push with strength and impact our IQOS business and globally our reduced risk portfolio. And last but not least, we think that you know, that's probably an encouragement if we continue to be a tough player in CC and defending our position for other tobacco players to also switch to reduced risk product. So we view that as positive. And again, there is no contradiction in the vision. We want to keep the C category, but you know, as long as the C is there for us for the time being, we want to retain a strong position there.
And how big a deal is Aluma in terms of the next stage of the growth of the business?
I'm sure you perceived the excitement, the enthusiasm behind the launch of IQOS ILUMA. I would summarize that by saying that we believe we're going to kill the remaining pain point that some of the users are having today with IQOS 3. And so, of course, you know, you will see when the product will be available. That is enabling us to target higher conversion. So there are probably people who haven't yet, you know, made the test and we are not using IQOS today that we think, you know, could move now thanks to this better, even better product, IQOS ILUMA, to heat-not-burn product. We believe that it will also drive a higher full conversion. As you know, you have a number of, little bit less than 30% of the IQOS user, which are still using potentially, you know, cigarettes, or poly usage of product. We think that, you know, it should drive a higher level of full conversion. We believe it should drive higher retention and lower level of abandonment because, you know, problem that we can have with cleaning, blade issue, that's going to disappear. So, you know, some of the difficulty is going to disappear. So we think it's going to lower the level of abandonment. And altogether, it's going to increase the net promoter score and loyalty of IQOS customers. So we see that as having potentially a very nice impact on volume growth and the trajectory on the long term.
To what extent do you think the industry is pivoting to favor heat not burn over vaping as the category in the new nicotine environment, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, we all have to admit that in this reduced risk product, you will have various type of expectation. You know, markets are different, and consumer may have different needs and expectation. Now, one thing I think is becoming very clear is that when you want to convert smokers, you need to deliver an experience that is as close as smoking as possible. Otherwise, what do you risk? Well, you risk poly usage. So people, you know, from time to time use another RP, but they continue to smoke to a large extent. Or you are going to generate abandonment. People try something and then they be back to the cigarette. And therefore, if you want to deliver an experience that is very close to cigarette, with heat not burn, and of course heat not burn with the best of the technology, and here again, you know, it makes a difference, but that's what we are providing with IQOS. It's going to be, we think, as I said, even more the case with IQOS ILUMA. You are really mimicking the overall experience, and then that's why we think on the long term you're going to be much more successful to convert smokers to heat not burn. And that's why we think the heat not burn category, again with the right technology, is a winning one today. Everybody can see that. And you have not only, you know, a fast growing market, but also a higher loyalty and probably, you know, the stickiness of the change is much, much, much higher for the reason I've just described. You know, we always take the example of, a ristretto, you know, coffee drinker. So you are used to ristretto and you want to change, you know, but of course you love your ristretto experience. Well, that's when you are a smoker. So you drink ristretto. If you go to IQOS, you're going to have a nice espresso. Okay. You know, full of flavor and still nicely powerful. Of course, you know, in our case with a significant harm reduction. If you go for an Americano, you know, a kind of coffee, we can have a debate, you know, on whether it's close to coffee or not. Well, some can get used to it, but it's going to be quite a different experience. Well, it's probably what you're going to get with a lot of the vaping experience. So that explains why it's more difficult to switch smokers to vaping. I don't know whether the image, you know, speaks for itself, but
yeah, I understand. So maybe the lack of the quality of the product and the relationship with the smoking meant that there, I think we would all conclude there probably wasn't a first mover advantage in vaping. Is there a first mover advantage in Heat Not Burn?
Well, I would phrase things in a different manner. What is the technology at stake to deliver vaping versus, you know, technology at stake to deliver Heat Not Burn? And I think what we see for the time being is that there is much more technology involved in a great Heat Not Burn experience. And that is explaining why, I don't know whether it's a first mover or at least the one owning the technology and having the right innovation, if you want. It's probably less clear for vaping, where you probably have experience matching each other with a much lower level of differentiation. So for me, I mean, we happen to be also the first mover, but I think it's first and foremost, we are the one coming with the right cutting edge innovation, and that is making a big difference for the customer.
Okay. If I move on slightly, one of my earlier questions was around the volumes in the business long term, given your statement of purpose, etc. But now, to contradict myself, do you believe combined combustible and nicotine volumes can turn positive for the industry?
Well, it has not been the case for the past
and 2 years.
So I would say difficult to see why today. I mean, I referred to a few, you know, markets in new economy that are growing very fast, like Vietnam or Bangladesh. So that can have an impact. But we know that otherwise there is a trend for a moderate decline in the overall nicotine market. And therefore in the combine, if you want, in not burn plus combustible. I don't see, you know, what today will change that dramatically. Now, it's going to depend, of course, of what is your exposure to Heat Not Burn that is growing very fast, you know, strong double digit. As you know, we have 80% of the category. We are growing in still 30% in, or close to 30% in volume in first quarter, reflecting to a large extent what we've done in 2020, by the way. So that is a very fast growing category. And the more this category is going to keep growing and the more it's going to have a big weight in the combined combustible plus Heat Not Burn, the more probably the CC category will be under pressure. So I believe that there is certainly a much better outlook for the players who are going to have big share and increasing shares in RP versus competitors that could be mainly predominantly principally exposed to CC. Now, to your question, as far as we are concerned, I think we flagged the fact that we are targeting to be on over the 21 to 23 period versus 2020 broadly flat in terms of volume. That's what we said, which would be a significant improvement. I mean, volume, of course, which would be a significant improvement versus the trend that we've seen since 2012, roughly speaking, where we have seen a decline in volume. So we would be already, if we were to deliver that performance, clearly benefiting from our strong exposure to the Heat Not Burn category.
Something just occurred, just questions popped into my head. Do you make a positive gross margin on the IQOS device, and do you care whether you do or not?
That's certainly a desirable objective, to at least be break even on the gross margin. We're not there yet today. It's again, you know, certainly it's desirable. Is it, you know, a big obsession for us? Not really. At the end of the day, it's quite important if we want to convert smoker to switch that we put the device in their hand. Okay. And we know that there is a price at which it's going to happen in a more easy way, than if, you know, we are at a very, very premium, positioning. And then it's not enough, because of course, then you have the overall experience, as I explained, between device, consumable, and then the kind of chemistry that is coming when you put the two together to replicate the overall experience of smoking. So one could see that actually as a nice commercial investment, you know, in order to convert people. And like any investment, it has to be assessed in, you know, what's the return that you get on the investment. What is the benefit of that investment? And it has to be, of course, at a reasonable level still to create value. So in a nutshell, that's the way I would be looking at this question mark on gross margin. Great if one day we can be on break even, but not an obsession. It's certainly a place where we are very happy today to make some commercial investments.
That answer makes absolutely perfect sense to me. It's a facilitation of the heat stick rather than being a profit pool in itself is how I would
absolutely
think about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So now maybe this is a bit further down the road, but we've touched on beyond nicotine, and I just want to think about what that may mean for margins in your business vis-a-vis nicotine margins on a percentage basis. My gut sense is that they will be lower, but that probably won't matter on a dollar per unit basis if we can measure equivalent per units, because if there's no excise, your revenue is going to be higher, your percentage margin may be lower, but my sense is it may be neutral on a dollar per unit margin. Have you guys thought about that?
Now, of course, we're working on it. A couple of comments, Jerry, on that one. First of all, on everything linked to better health and what we call respiratory drug delivery, I don't necessarily see a lower margin. We're going to come with something that will be making a real difference for the people. And of course, you know, it comes with a value and a price for it. Then on the part that is linked with well-being and lifestyle, it's going to be a whole world of new experience, which is going to be really, you know, delivering great pleasure, self-indulgence, personal benefit. And that's going to come with an overall great experience in terms of combining device and the product. It's going to come as a great, you know, lifestyle, I would say, overall construction and branded, of course, you know, like what we're doing on IQOS. You know, it's going to be something that is going to appeal to the consumer in terms of status, in terms of conviviality, in terms of moment shared, or just in terms of personal enjoyment. So we really believe that there is here a market with a lot of value, because we will deliver great value to the consumer, and the consumer is always ready to pay for you know, the value that he is perceiving from the product. So combination of innovation, great brand, great product, of course, still the commercial strengths of PMI, we think that this can be a very nicely profitable business.
Okay, your answer has pinged one more question in my mind before I go to the last one. Time is running out. Things will change a lot over the years to come. But as the current management team, whatever happens in terms of the product portfolio moving forward, Philip Morris at its center will always be, is it fair to say, will always be a consumer goods business rather than a quasi-pharma technology business? How do you think about that?
That's absolutely our vision. You know, we don't ambition to become a pharmaceutical company. And when we talk about respiratory drug delivery, which I guess is what is behind your question, I think it's not about developing new molecules, but rather, you know, how do we bring in an impactful manner things that, you know, today are, I don't know, if you take, we always, you know, take the example of aspirin that you're going to take through tablets. If you manage to deliver it through inhalation, having a much faster impact that in many, many circumstances can be very important. We're not recreating, you know, of course, the molecule behind aspirin. We're just innovating on how you bring it to the patient, to the consumer, and that's how we create value. So it's a kind of consumer good, if you want, or specific angle. It's not about putting billion of R&D in a molecule development, if okay. It answers your question.
Understood. So the last question is not particularly original, but I feel like I have to ask it. It's the final wrap-up. The smile on your face probably tells me you know what's coming. Could you talk?
I don't know why. I have a sense of what it could be.
Could you talk about the balance sheet, the share buyback, where we are on dividend payout, bearing in mind the dollar dividend, the non-dollar revenues, etc.? Could you just talk about the latest thoughts around all of that?
Fair question on capital allocation, Jerry. Well, first of all, on the buyback, we said it at the end of Q1. We are on track, given the outlook for the year, to start our buyback program in H2, but we are still waiting for the approval of the board on this program. So we know we need to follow the rules, but of course, we'll inform the market once we have got there and when we are in a position to launch the buyback program. And on the dividend, we've been very clear. You know, we have a progressive dividend, so there is just one way for the dividend, which is up, and that's what people should expect. At the same time, we said that today we have a pretty high payout ratio. Of course, you know, with a nice expected growth on profit here, we have a way to, I would say, make it evolve in the right direction. And we signal the fact that on the long term, we did not give an horizon for that, but on the long term, we want to have a payout ratio of dividend on net profit to be about adjusted net profit to be about 75%. So we, you know, it's probably going to take a few years before we get there, but that means that we're not necessarily increase every year the dividend in line with the growth of the net profit. But of course, we're going to keep rewarding our shareholders with nice growth of the dividend.
Emmanuel, time has beaten us. I found that a very informative session. Hopefully, those joining us did likewise. Thank you very much for your time.
Great
Thank
pleasure
you.
to be with you, Jerry. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.